Welcome to the Locked Room. Stories from the golden age of mystery and crime detection fiction. I'm Mardell, reading Blind Corner by Dornford Yates. Chapter 8, The Race for the Chamber. The next morning, we held a short council. The system of reliefs, which had served us so long and so well, was now a thing of the past, and we were all agreed that once we had closed our bases, except to communicate with Carson or to go out as a spy, no one must leave the dungeon until the treasure was won. That the stranger whom Hanbury had seen was the tanner's brother, we had no doubt. And to judge from the fellow's demeanor, so far as we were concerned, the two were at one with the thieves. If this were so, since they were the innkeeper's allies, our enemies now numbered 8 instead of 5. Yet neither of these conclusions troubled us near so much as the thought that Rose Noble must know that there was a second entrance into the oubliette. This was a serious matter, for now that he knew, he would not rest till he had found it. And as if that were not enough, we had left him a definite clue. Rowley had covered our tracks as best he could, but he could not repair the door which Mansell had forced. Its broken condition the thieves were bound to remark. And the instant they saw it, they would know that the entrance they sought led out of the castle itself. And so, said Mansell, it's only a matter of time. It may take them a day or an hour, but in the end they'll find it, and then the balloon will go up. Now, if we guarded the trap, though they found it, to force an entry that way it might be very hard, for 3 men armed in the darkness could hold it against an army similarly equipped. But what a man has done once, he will do again. And we had little doubt that if we opposed their entry, they would at once resort to the use of that terrible weapon which they had already employed, that is to say, of bombs. And stand up to these we could not, if for no other reason, because against such an attack no man born of woman could hope to hold such a place. We could bar the postern of knights. We could set an electric alarm above the stile. We could keep watch, but more we could not do, and must try the fortune of war when the moment came. But Mansell decided that in future we must always go armed, even though we were working at the nose of the shaft. It was then arranged that the next morning I should go to the culvert, and taking the rolls from Carson, send him back to the dungeon, and myself drive to St. Martin for the last time. You see, said Mansell, at the moment we're not up against time, but I shouldn't be surprised if we were before the curtain comes down. Give me 5 minutes start, and I'll be at Calais 5 hours before Rose Noble, but not if I've got to trip round paying my bills. So we'll do 3 more reliefs. When you've bade farewell to St. Martin, Hanbury can visit Vallac, and then I can go to Salzburg and make all smooth and clear for us to withdraw. I think we should each go alone, because 4 is none too many to hold the fort. And I think we'll have Tester here. He'll rather like this place, and he'll be devilish useful watching that trap. With that we talked no more, but went to work. Mansell and Hanbury to setting the electric alarm, and Rowley and Bell and I to driving the shaft. 13 days had gone by since we had altered our course, and so well had we wrought in this time that but 23 yards lay between us and what we had come to call live ground. We gave it that name because, though we knew it was surrounding the chamber, as a garden a house, we were far less certain where within it the chamber lay. We hoped and believed that by holding straight on through this region, we should strike some part of the chamber Before we had gone 5 yards, we were equally sure that if we had not found it in 9, this would be because we had passed it, and in such an event we proposed to go no further, but to drive a new shaft at right angles through the middle of the live ground. We had made up our minds that this region was not more than 9 yards square, and we steadfastly refused to consider that somewhere within its area the chamber did not lie. Whether the progress we made was actually swift or slow, I cannot fairly pronounce, for how 6 sextons would have fared had they been set such a task, I cannot say. But what we lacked in experience, I think we made up in zeal. And, after all, digging is a simple downright business, which one man, if he will, can soon do as well as another. Be that as it may, I do not think any men could have labored more heartily than we had, since our brush with the tanner upon the 9th night of June. But now, since our life was to be less easy, we determined to cut our confinement as short as ever we could, and to that end redouble our efforts to reach our goal. We had not much hope of doing so before the thieves discovered the trap, but there was the chance that we might, and faint though this was, this certainly spurred us on, for although we were ready enough to show our teeth, once such a battle was joined, no one could possibly tell what the outcome would be. And there, of course, the thieves had a valuable advantage, for if one of them was wounded, the others would let him lie or die for want of attention, rather than care for him to the cost of their enterprise. But if one of us was hurt and needed a doctor's aid, everything else, of course, would go by the board. In this sense, the dice were loaded. And though hitherto we had been most fortunate, the spectre always haunted each passage of arms that we had. Full of these thoughts, we worked as hard as we could, and by the end of that day had actually advanced 5 yards, so that but 18 remained between us and the live ground. At 1 o'clock the next morning, I left for the culvert, charged by Mansell to swim down the middle of the river, and not to attempt to land for 1/4 of a mile. I was then to strike across country, by no means to use the road until I had left the junction 2 miles behind. Directly I had found Carson, I was to send him back, for else it would be broad daylight before he could reach the chute. "Indeed," said Mansell, "I'm banking on your meeting by 2:30, for Carson is sure to be early, and so, I think, are you, for the culvert is less than 4 miles as the crow flies. Tell him on no account to let Tester off the lead, and to hold the end in his mouth as he swims to the chute." I was at the culvert at 2:30, and had just found the note which Carson had lodged in the brickwork under the arch, when I heard a step above me, and there he was. 2 minutes later, he and Tester were gone, and I was turning the rolls. There was little to do at St. Martin, except to collect my belongings and pay my bill. But I had to explain how it was that I came a day late and alone, and without the basket which my hostess had so often put up. I might have found this hard, but between their relief to see me and their distress to learn that I should return no more, the good people seemed to have no room left for surprise. Indeed, I might have been a fugitive monarch resting at the house of a loyal before resuming his flight, for they could not do enough to show their esteem and goodwill. And when at last I left them, I had to give them my word that I would come back one day, and even so, enough honest tears were shed to make me feel ashamed that I had imposed so much upon their simplicity. Hanbury met me at the culvert, but had nothing at all to report, save that another 5 yards had been added to the length of the shaft, and by the time he was back on the following day, we were within 8 yards of the live ground. We were all glad of Tester, and Tester was glad of us. He soon understood that when there was no one to spare, He was expected to guard the oubliette, and I think he enjoyed wandering about in the darkness, for now we burn no lights, except in the gallery and at the nose of the shaft. And conducting an endless scrutiny of the great banks of earth, the chute seemed to fascinate him, and he always contrived to be present when its flap was withdrawn. I fancy he thought that it must have been made by some beast, and was continually hoping that its creator would emerge. When Carson took his leave, I could not help wondering when we should see him again, for with Mansell's return the last of our reliefs would be over, and if all went well, the next time we crossed the river would be the last. He was very loath to leave us, and constantly lamented that he had not killed Rose Noble on the night when we visited the well. 1 minute more, he would say, and I should have had him cold, and that would have saved us a peck of trouble, sir, for if ever I saw one, there goes a dangerous man. Be sure I agreed with him, and yet I must honestly confess that if we had suddenly learned that the thieves had withdrawn, the game would have lost a curiously attractive savor, which even the lifting of the treasure would not have wholly restored. For danger, once you've tasted it, is a superlative spice. If Carson was loath to go, we were sorry enough to lose him, for he was a fine workman and a first-class shot. What was more, he had the brain of a fighter, and though there might be no one to lead him, could be trusted to think for himself and to hold his own. However, neither Rowley nor Bell could manage a car as could he. Besides which, it was good to know that our line of retreat was held by such capable hands. His instructions were clear. So soon as he had reached Salzburg, he was to lay up the rolls, and taking the second car, drive her to Villach. There he was to bestow her at the inn which Hanbury had used, and then to return by train in search of the rolls. After that he was to go no more to Salzburg, but to take up his quarters at Villach, holding both cars in condition to leave at an instant's notice by day or night. Each night at 11 o'clock he was to be at the culvert, and having concealed the rolls, to wait there till 12. He was then to walk a point to a mile and a half away, where 7 trees grew together on the top of a hill. From here could be seen the castle and a slice of the river below. If he saw nothing unusual, he was to go his way. If he saw one window lighted, he was to return to the culvert and wait till we came. If he saw 2 illumined, he was to leave the rolls and come to the chute. But if all 3 were aglow, he was to get the rolls and drive down past the junction and on to the Luray Road. We had little to report to Mansell beyond that our progress had been slow, for since he had left we had only advanced 3 yards, because we had encountered a boulder as big as a sheep, the dislodgment and disposal of which had taken the best part of 5 hours. But if instead of progressing we had actually retired, I do not think Mansell would have cared, because he was so much relieved to find that the secret of the trap was still inviolate, and that we had not, in his absence, been called upon to fight for our lives. That day we made a great effort, and by 8 o'clock that evening we had reached the coveted region and had broken the live ground. Our excitement now began to run high, and I was for bolting my supper in order to get back to work. But Mansell said he should like to visit the comb, and me to go with him. "It may seem idle," he said, "but those who don't look don't see. To visit the well or the castle would take more time than I think we can fairly spare, but to go to the comb and back will take us less than an hour. I hope and believe it will be our last reconnaissance, but I think we ought to make it before we take off our coats for the final push." And so we went out together when it was dark. Hanbury told me later that when we returned, Mansell was rather pale, but I looked an older man. I have no doubt I did, for though we had seen no one and heard no sound, what we had found was enough to age any man who thinks the fruits of his labor worth taking up. At the foot of the gutter, we had found a miniature lake. Now, whilst we were drawing water, we had never gone down to see the pool we had made, and though we all remembered the sodden condition of the ground on the day I was taken by Ellis, that was nothing to go by, for then no water had been drawn for 18 or 20 hours. We had, therefore, the bare fact before us, that the enemy was making, for the first time, a truly formidable effort to empty the well. A feat which we had accomplished in less than 3 days, how long they had been at work, how much water they had drawn, how the results of their labor were comparing with those of ours, we could not so much as guess. But what 6 men had done, 8 men could do, and this indisputable verity, sternly illustrated by the lake at the foot of the comb, bade fair to sap the resolution from which our endeavors sprang. I can only speak for myself, but I know that when I was back in the gallery, I felt tired and was glad to sit down, and that when Bell brought me dry shoes, the business of changing seemed a burden, and I told him to put them down and let me be. Then I heard Mansell laugh. "Rose noble deeds," he said lightly, "and yet I'll back the old firm. There's the strait to be covered yet, and I fancy they're full of running. Besides, I don't know how you fellows feel, but I haven't shoveled dirt for 6 weeks for the pleasure of watching Rose Noble pick my peach. And then again, the game's the thing. And now let's see where we stand. As yet, they've not got to the shaft. That is clear, for that water was drawn today, but the gutter was dry, which means they've stopped work for the night. If it was over, and they'd found, there would be so much water at the foot of the comb, for once they've uncovered the shaft, they've only to bale to keep the water down, and 5 hours baling wouldn't make all that mess. Again, I know they're 8, but only 4 will draw water as fast as we. And one of those, Rose Noble, has something better to do, for you can't command such a rabble and bear a hand as well. Besides, I'll stake my oath that water to draw or no, Rose Noble is still trying to find the way to the oubliette. And I think it more than likely that they're keeping an eye on the chute. And, last of all, they none of them know of the bars. And that's a fruit of a thought, for I'll lay my soul to a cesspool that apart from anything else they're short of a file. With that he ordered Rowley to open a case of champagne. For though, said he, I meant us to drink it when the treasure had been won, now that I come to think, we might not have time. It seems a pity to leave it for Ellison Rose. I can relate his words, but I cannot describe the way in which he spoke them, or the quiet, confident manner with which he seemed to be putting misfortune to shame. Enough that he lifted us up and carried us all away. And since neither Hanbury nor I would wait for the wine, Mansell himself brought a bottle to the nose of the shaft and made us drink. We worked straight through that night, and it was 8 the next morning before Mansell called a halt. By then we had tunneled 4 yards into the live ground. This had meant working at a tremendous pace, for we faithfully maintained its dimensions and propped the shaft as we went. The heat was awful and the want of air most vile, but we had grown used to these conditions, from which we had begun to suffer, as soon as we turned the shaft. Still we came down into the gallery, swaying like drunken men, and Hanbury and Bell fell asleep over their food. Then Mansell told Rowley and me to take our rest, and said that he should take Tester and sleep in the oubliette. I believe he said something else, for I remember laughing, but before my laughter was over, I was asleep. Now how long Mansell slept, I do not know, but he woke us at noon to say he had sunk a crowbar at the nose of the shaft and had encountered water 4 feet below its floor. Except that he had found the chamber, he could not have brought us more encouraging news, for it showed that we had at last no vertical error to fear, and that roughly our floor was level with that of the chamber itself. In a moment, therefore, we were wide awake and afoot, and all agog to return to the nose of the shaft. But of this Menzel would not hear until we had all of us bathed and broken our fast. "Method in all things," he said. "Disorder never won yet and never will. We went off the deep end last night, but we're not going to do it again. From now on, we'll labor by shifts. There'll always be 4 at work and 1 at rest. I don't know how much we can stand, but it won't be for long, and 4 hours on to 1 off seems the most convenient rule." And whilst we were eating, he outlined what must be done to cope with a sudden attack. "The one who is off duty must sleep in the oubliette. Tester will wake him all right in the event of an attack. The moment he's waked, he will withdraw to the ramp, of course, taking Tester with him, and close the postern gate, and he will hold the ramp, while the others will hold the shaft. In this way we shall have them between 2 fires, and if we don't loose off too soon, it ought to be a walkover." Then he told us to mind how we went at the head of the ramp, as well as at the mouth of the shaft, because he had built 2 breastworks out of some sacks of earth.
"Why, you can't have rested at all!" cried Hanbury.
"I had 2 full hours," said Menzel, "and now I'm going to have 1 more. Chandos, what time do you make it?"
I told him 12:20.
"I shall be your relief," said he. "I count upon you to wake me at 1:30." I suppose I hesitated, for he continued at once. "Unless you give me your word, I shall not sleep."
"I promise," said I.
"Very good," said Menzel. "But if before then you strike oil, well, I don't mind being called early to hear the news."
5 minutes later we were at the nose of the shaft. We had still 5 yards to go before we should come to the end of the belt of live ground, but though we went steadily forward, we now took to searching right and left, by dint of driving a crowbar, as though it were a great nail, into the wall. Again and again by this means we thought we had found the chamber, but when we had laid bare the obstruction, each time it proved to be some boulder or 2 or 3 smaller stones. In this way the tunnel began to lose its symmetry, and though this could not be helped, the propping of the roof with timber became a less downright business and wasted a lot of time. We worked frantically, speaking very little, but doing the best we could to maintain the system of labor which should turn to the best account such joint strength as we had. The hewer stood on a sheet, onto which his winnings must fall. As soon as these began to encumber him, he would stand back and away. At once his assistant would draw back the sheet from the face and lay in its place another to catch the next fall of earth. The assistant then disposed of the soil he had drawn away, and by the time he was back the second sheet would be full. The carpenter followed the hewer as close as he could, pitching his uprights and crossbars and wedging them into place, and the fourth was the man of all work, now shoveling loose earth that had fallen clear of the sheet, or had not fallen, now helping the carpenter, and now bringing up fresh wood. 1 hour before his relief, each man had a pint of champagne, and when he was waked was given 1/4 hour in which to bathe and eat. Menzel fed Tester himself 2 in a day, and that was all the attention the poor dog had, yet he was as good as gold, never obtruding himself as so many dogs would have done, but seeming to know that we were fighting with time and faithfully keeping to his post in the oubliette. By 11 o'clock that night we had advanced 5 yards and were clear of the live ground. It was impossible, not to be disappointed, and very hard not to be dismayed. And when I had called for a crowbar, and with three mighty blows slammed this up to its head in the nose of the shaft, and touched not so much as a pebble, I think we all avoided each other's eyes. But Hanbury, for Mansell was resting, wasted no time. By his direction, we immediately withdrew 5 yards and began to drive a new tunnel out of the left-hand wall. For no reason that I can offer, the half-hour that followed seems for me to stand out of that period of toil and trouble, and I remember most vividly the sob of the hewer each time that he launched his pickaxe, and the smell of sweat and the blinding glare of the searchlight, and even a mark on a timber retaining the left-hand wall. To our right, the 5 yards we had won to no purpose continually mocked us, like the psalmist bulls of Bashan, gaping upon us with its mouth to our left. Our long, clean-cut gallery seemed to be leading fantastically into another world. I can see Hanbury poising the compass, and hear him curse as his sweat fell on his dial, and when Bell, who was hewing, missed his stroke, I remember snatching the pickaxe and missing mine. So the work went on, and the niche in the left-hand wall had grown to an entrance, when Hanbury looked at his wristwatch and cried that my time was up. I stumbled back to wake Mansell and fall asleep in his stead, for the champagne had done its business and my knees were beginning to sag. Almost at once Hanbury woke me and I started up with a cry. "Have you found?"
"Found be damned," said George. "You've had 5 minutes over your time."
So it was with us all, and we battled rather than labored, fighting with nature like madmen in our effort to find the chamber before she could wear us down. For the pace was too hot to last. We all knew that, and unless we could win very soon, we were playing a losing game. Yet we went steadily on like men in a dream, losing all count of time and confusing night with day. Indeed, the demands of the battle so wholly possessed our senses that, used in some other direction, these were beginning to fail. We shouted to one another when a whisper could have been heard. The hand that could still ply a hammer could not be trusted to raise a glass to the lips. And if ever I glanced at my wristwatch, this seemed a great way off. At 9:15 the next morning, our new shaft was 8 yards deep. And this alone shows that we were beside ourselves, for though we had cut down the width, relying upon the crowbar to make this good, such progress was superhuman. Yet to advance this shaft further seemed little worth. And we started another tunnel out of its right-hand wall, this by Hanbury's direction, for Mansell was resting, and we others knew no more where to turn than the man in the moon. "Are you certain," said I, "that we're not too far to the left?"
"Certain," said Hanbury. "Mansell will bear me out. The shaft from the well to the chamber is not so steep as we thought, so we've aimed too much to the right. You mark my words, if we don't strike the chamber this time, we shall hit the shaft."
Such confidence did us good. But when I roused Mansell, I saw him tighten his lips, and I know that he had been hoping to be sent for before his time. I now know that I must have slept for nearly my hour when I dreamed I was listening to Mansell broadcasting news, and that a storm somewhere was blotting out what he said. I must have dreamed for some moments, for I was heavy with sleep, but at last I awoke to find Tester barking like fury 3 feet away. In an instant I had caught him up and had blundered through the postern to fall headlong over the breastwork with a dog in my arms. However, I was up in a moment and made haste to close the gate, but I dared not fasten it closely for fear of a bomb. I had much ado to quiet Tester, who was seething with wrath, but when I had done so and could listen, I heard no sound, So we lay still for 5 minutes. Then I heard Mansell's voice. "Are you at your post, Chandos?"
"I am," said I.
"What happened?"
"I've no idea," I said. "I woke up to find Tester barking. That's as much as I know."
"Stay where you are," he said.
Then he unmasked the searchlight and turned the beam onto the trap. Presently, he raked the dungeon, letting the beam discover the timber and piles of earth at length.
"Let Tester go," he said, "and you come in." The dog ran to him at once and jumped up to lick his face. Then he turned away and began to growl and bristle with his eyes on the trap.
"Not much doubt about that," said Mansell, stooping to make much of the dog. "Our friends have found the front door. I suppose they're not quite ready, and that's why they shut it again. Well, we're quite ready, and when they are, until then, we may as well work."
Then he sent me to bathe and eat, and when I came back, Hanbury was asleep in the dungeon, and Tester in the crook of his arm. We gave no more time to the riddle, for in truth we had none to give. The business smacked of a nightmare, yet our present life was a dream, and so, if we thought, we did not speak of it, but tacitly took it for granted that Mansell's interpretation was good. At 6 o'clock that evening, we started another shaft. The last we had driven 5 yards and had sunk a 3-foot crowbar into its nose, and found nothing. And so, at 6 o'clock, we started another shaft. This was driven from the nose of our second, so that our original tunnel would soon be a left-handed fork with 3 5-yard prongs. And here I am bound to record that we were beginning to fail. I will swear that the spirit was willing, but the flesh was beginning to flag. It was nearly 45 hours since Mansell and I had returned from our reconnaissance, and though in that time we had each had 10 hours sleep, the reconnaissance had come at the end of a full day's toil. We had, therefore, been jaded when we began to spurt, and our spurt was losing its sting because it did not end. We were beginning to fail. I knew that my strength was failing, and tried to conceal the fact. I fancy the others did the same, for the collapse of one must mean the end of our effort. The camel's back would have broken. Not even Mansell could have carried another straw. When I roused him at 7:30, he held up 2 canvas kit bags for me to see. "The burglar's delight," said he with half a laugh. I tried to laugh back and lay down, but not to sleep. And there was the surest sign that the end was at hand, for it showed that the flesh was rebelling against its chastisement. When Mansell returned from the gallery, he stopped to peer at me. I pretended slumber, but his action showed me that he, too, had not slept. I think the hour that followed was the worst I have ever spent. I was so sick and weary that I would have sold a kingdom for unconsciousness. But this was steadfastly withheld, and though at times I fell into a kind of doze, this state was more dreadful than my first, for then my brain was unruly and flitted and gambolled as a gnat on a summer's eve. I was indeed thankful when Hanbury limped into the dungeon, and I could go back in his place. The gallery we were now driving was completing the uppermost prong of the letter E, the upright of which was formed by our second shaft and the base or bottom prong by the last 5 yards of our first. But because of all our soundings, the works had a shapeless look and seemed to reflect the frenzy with which they had been done. The roof and walls were eccentric, and the timbers were all awry. Indeed, the carpenter's task was now fit work for a wizard, and faithfully to prop and retain such irregular excavation was almost impossible. At 10:30 that night, our new shaft was 2 yards deep. Mansell, Hanbury, and I were working alone, for Bell had just left to rouse Rowley and take his place. And all was quiet, for Mansell had stopped for a moment to drink his wine. Hanbury was penciling a timber, which he was going to saw, and I, who was hewing, was extracting a morsel of dirt which had made its way into my eye. At first, I thought Hanbury's pencil was making a scraping noise, then I saw he had stopped and was listening, and that Mansell was doing the same. For a moment, no one of us moved. Then Hanbury stepped to my side and set his ear to a hole, in which the crowbar had made a foot back in the left-hand wall. "That's right," said he after a moment. "It's coming from here." Then he stood away, and I made play with the pickaxe about the hole. I had soon made a hollow, in which by sinking the crowbar we should gain another foot, but before we did this, Mansell tore off his zephyr and folded it into a pad which should muffle the sound of the blows. Gently I drove the bar home, and could almost have pressed it for the last foot of its way, and I drew it out with my hands without any effort at all. The noise was distinct now, a thin, regular murmur, as if someone was whetting a chisel upon a hone. What it was I could not imagine, and was just beginning to think that our calculations had led us to the top of the well, when Mansell let out a sob and caught each of us by an arm. "My God, I've got it!" he cried. "That's the chamber ahead, and they're filing the bars." There is, I believe, a height at which a man's heart will break, and so, I suppose, there is a pitch of excitement at which a man's brain will balk. And I think we had come to this, for Mansell was trembling as a man smitten with ague. If I had tried to speak, I should have broken down, and while we were standing thus silent, Hanbury's knees sagged, and he fell down in a swoon. The faint was nothing, and before I had brought the bucket, which was standing 10 paces away, George was again on his feet, but we made him dip his head in the water, and then Mansell and I did the same. Then we fell to like madmen to deepen the breach I had made. We worked in what silence we could, and let the carpentry go. Each of us hewed for 2 minutes, while the others withdrew his winnings and strewed them about the shafts. Now and again we had to employ the shovel, but mostly we used our hands, so as to make less noise. All the time, the noise of the filing went steadily on, only ceasing from time to time to instantly recommence. Each time that it stopped, our hearts went into our mouths, for close as we were, if once the bars were severed, we might have been 5 miles off for all the good we could do. When Rowley came back, we told him and sent him back to tell Bell. "And say," said Mansell, "that I may not arrive when I should, but that whatever happens, he must remain where he is, for now the case is altered, and he and Tester are holding our line of retreat." Rowley was back in 2 minutes, and wild to take his turn, and once he had got it, he would not surrender the pickaxe. I had to fairly wrest it out of his hands. Now, what time was when it happened, I do not know, for I cannot tell to an hour how long we took to cut through that last 3 feet. But I know that I launched the pickaxe, and its head went out of my sight, and there I was, looking through a hole into empty space, beyond which, when they gave me the light, I could see a stone wall. It was the chamber, indeed. At once I saw that the well digger's excavation had been bigger than the chamber itself, and that they had not lined the cavity which they had dug, but had built the chamber within it, like a box within a box. There was now no mistaking the whine of iron biting iron, and it sounded to our frantic ears as though whosoever was filing was nearing the end of his task. We therefore fell to like fury, and soon had a ragged window, I suppose, some 3 feet square, opening into the cavern in which the chamber stood. A moment's inspection now showed that the chamber was round, like the well, and was plainly constructed of stones, which had been cut by the masons to build the walls of the well. To break out of the chamber, therefore, would have been 10 times as simple as to break in, for the stones were undoubtedly wedge-shaped, and that being so, if they were truly laid, a battering ram itself would not avail us. The joints, moreover, were as fine as those of the walls of the well. To cut out one stone with a chisel would have taken an hour or more.
"What of the roof?" whispered Mansell. At once I stretched up an arm to find the roof just out of sight, but 2 minutes' work with a pickaxe had laid the edge of it bare. Now, how the roof was constructed, I do not know, but between the slab we could see and the stones upon which it was resting, there was a layer of mortar as thick as Camembert cheese, and this was so loose that I picked out a piece with my thumb. Here, then, was the way to break in, for we had but to drive a chisel, and when it was fairly in, to lever against the slab, to prise a stone out of the wall. And once one stone was out, we could make our breach.
"And when we do," breathed Mansell, "look out for squalls. You can bet your life they're not going to give us this trick." We had to make way for the lever, so once more I handled the pickaxe, whilst the others marshaled the tools for the final assault. All this time the filing continued, and to judge from the ring of the metal, some bar was nearly in two. Indeed, as I threw down the pickaxe, again the noise stopped, and we heard some blows administered, as though the workman believed he could burst asunder the filament that remained. We waited to hear no more. I fitted the edge of the chisel into the chink, and whilst I held it, Mansell hammered it home. The stone below must have been loose, for the moment we levered it yielded, and a second later I pulled it out with my hands. The two below came away, and as Hanbury gave me the searchlight, I heard a strangled cry. On the tiny floor was a bag, thick, covered with dust, of the shape of a sack of corn. Its mouth was shut, but one of its sides was gaping and spilling the stuff it held. By its side was another, but this was all gone to ruin, and its contents lay in a heap. The dust lay so deep over all that it might have been trash, but I saw the shape of a crucifix standing up out of the ruck. Immediately opposite was the entrance, barred by the 4 iron bars. Behind these I saw 2 faces unshaven like those of beasts. The one I had never seen, but the other was that of Ellis. And that I believe I shall see so long as I live, for if ever the devil possessed the soul of a man, he possessed it then. The other seemed blinded by the searchlight, but Ellis glared full at the lamp as though it were no more than a taper, with his face working with passion and his eyes starting out of its head. Suddenly he laid hold of the bars and wrenched them this way and that, screaming like some animal with rage, and when they would not yield to his frenzy, he clapped his face up against them and spat like any demoniac, lending the whole force of his body to this disgusting act. Then he started as one who recovers his presence of mind, and I saw a hand fly to his hip. At that moment Mansell fired, and the fellow fell suddenly forward against the bars. As he did so, the other man turned, and Mansell fired again. But when the noise had subsided, we could hear him descending the shaft. Then Ellis's body slipped sideways, till the head was against the wall, which held it up at an angle which was different to that of the trunk.
"God forgive me," said Mansell, "but I'd do it again."
With that I climbed into the chamber, and Mansell followed me in. With the hammer and crowbar, we soon had 3 more stones out, and Hanbury made his way in. Then Mansell told Rowley to give him the canvas bags,
"And quick's the motto," said he. "I missed the tanner, now he'll give the alarm. But once we're beyond the postern, they can have the oubliette." Rowley had brought the bags and was standing without the chamber looking in, with his hands on the wall, when I heard a rustle behind him and saw him drop suddenly forward across the breach we had made. A mass of soil had broken away from the window and had fallen on the back of his legs. He was not hurt, but was pinned, and whilst I supported his body, Mansell and Hanbury climbed back into the tunnel and shifted the fallen earth. They worked feverishly, but 2 or 3 minutes went by before he was free, and I was able to help him into the chamber. "And that," breathed Mansell, brushing the dirt from his hands, "is about as clear a time signal as ever there was." I held one canvas bag open, and Rowley the other, while Mansell and Hanbury shoveled the stuff within. There were gold, and stones, and jewels, and all manner of lovely things, but I think we were thinking of safety and the way to the oubliette. Then Mansell lifted his head and touched Hanbury on the arm. For a moment we knelt there, listening. Then something faint but clear came Tester's vigorous bark. And that was the only time we heard him give tongue that night. For the next instant came a shuffling and then a rumbling sound, and when we had brought the searchlight up to the breach in the wall, had we not known its angle, we could not have told where the shaft we had driven had been. "Where's the pickaxe?" said Mansell quietly. I told him it had lain in the shaft. Then came another rumble, and the searchlight went out. Please join me next time for the final outcome in Blind Corner by Dornford Yates, here on The Locked Room. In the meantime, beware of footsteps in the dark.